This episode of Off Air is brought to you by The Madison, the new Paramount Plus original series, streaming now exclusively on Paramount Plus.
The Madison is the kind of drama I love. Big emotions, unforgettable characters, and a story that really pulls you in. It stars Michelle Pfeiffer and Kurt Russell, and it is a powerful tale of courage, hope, and healing.
When their life is turned upside down by the death of their husband and father, the women of the Clyburn family travel from New York to the family ranch in Montana he loved so much. While there, they realise they need to overcome their fractured family dynamics and come together to navigate their loss.
All episodes are out now, so it's perfect for a binge watch. It's told through strong female characters, and you really see their bravery and resilience following an unthinkable tragedy.
So why not give it a watch? Stream the new original series, The Madison, now, only on Paramount Plus.
This episode of Off Air is sponsored by the Department for Work and Pensions.
When it comes to the job market, it's tough out there for young people.
Young people you know might worry that they don't have the grades, skills or experience they've been told they need.
Or maybe they're sending out application after application only to be ghosted or rejected without feedback. It can be a draining process and can take a real toll on their mental health.
But there is support out there for them. DWP's Job Help website has got loads of tips on improving their job search, learning new skills, and getting access to government support. And it also tells them which sectors are recruiting right now and where to look for different types of jobs and apprenticeships.
Now, when I was in my early 20s and out of work, I don't think I've ever been so low. I felt really frustrated at times. But when I did get myself into full-time work, it was such a confidence boost. And Fee, in some ways, you know, I've never looked back.
It's very true. Look at you now. If anybody listening knows or is themselves a young person struggling to find work, there is support out there. DWP's Job Help website has got loads of tips.
Learn more about what government support is available. Search Job Help today. This episode of Off Air is sponsored by Cancer Research UK's Race for Life, a series of 3K, 5K, 10K and pretty muddy obstacle courses where people of all ages and abilities come together to help fund life-saving cancer research.
Whether you're a stroll to the local cafe person or a seasoned sprinter, there are over 450 events happening in 150 locations across the UK from May to July. You can walk, jog or get stuck into the pretty muddy obstacle course.
It's all about going all in. It's that collective spirit. Families, friends and entire neighbourhoods joining forces. Whether you're racing for someone you love or just want to feel part of something bigger, every single sign-up is a step towards breakthroughs.
And your fundraising is supported every step of the way with tips, resources and ideas to help you hit your goal.
And right now you can get 50% off your Race for Life entry when you use the code SPRING26.
So grab your trainers and let's do this. Sign up now and get 50% off entry to your local 3K, 5K, 10K or Pretty Muddy event. Visit raceforlife.org/offair for details. Discount ends 19th of April 2026. T's and C's apply.
Right, welcome on board. It is, now it's strictly speaking, it's Maundy Thursday, isn't it?
It is. Have you brought me a small pouch with some coinage in it in your capacity as...
As what? Ecclesiastical affairs correspondent.
The monarch does that, doesn't it? They, yes. He or she.
Yeah, they do.
They give money to the poor. I remember it was very exciting when the Queen visited Winchester Cathedral.
To do it
on Maundy Thursday. Mm.
Yeah. It is actually, in its own way, rather a lovely tradition.
Yeah, it is. I think it's one of the good ones. What's in the pouch, though, these days?
Commemorative coinage of some
is
sort,
it? Okay.
I think, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
They don't do tap and pay now.
No, I imagine.
Just go along and beep.
And ask the king for a donation. I mean, he's got a few quid.
Yeah, was it £5, £10, £15? Your choice.
£5,000, £50,000, £500,000, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is our last... Oh, no, it's not, because we've got the book club podcast tomorrow when we discuss Neville Shute's A Town Like Alice. And thank you so much to everybody who took part in that. And you can get that podcast tomorrow. We recorded it yesterday.
Yep. And feel free, if you listen to it and completely disagree with us, to drop us an email over the Easter weekend. I need to say a huge thank you to Fiona, who says, "Hello, Feet. Now, this is a handwritten card, Jane. The very moment your Times literary chap, that's Robbie Millen, said Capital by John Lanchester was the very same moment I was putting said book into my charity shop bag. When you said you hadn't read it, I took that as a sign from the universe that I should gift it to you." Now, all of this high excitement happened on our afternoon show, which is between 2 and 4. I'm just going to say it quietly without the corporate Kathy speed.
Go on.
It's between 2 and 4. It happens on Monday to Thursday, and it's available on a DAB radio in your car and also on the app if you download it. All of those things are free. It's a bit tricky on a car, actually. I had to scan mine about 3 times.
It is a bit, but I don't think we should focus on that.
To do it. Yeah, but don't be disheartened.
Oh, no, keep trying.
Keep trying, yeah.
Take a week off if you have to.
We keep you company between 2 and 4. And this was in our book slot, which was with Robbie Millen, and he always brings us fun times. He's very naughty, actually. Got me into a lot of trouble last week. Not a very expensive gift, I admit, back with Fiona. A bit of a cheapskate, more in fact. But it's sent with lots of love and appreciation to half of the entity known as Fee and Jane, or is it Jane and Fee? Never know. Neither do we, although contractually we do. Here we're very much Jane and Fee, aren't we?
There was
back at the other place.
Huge change.
It was massive. Really hurt. Long may you reign over Times Towers. Have a lovely Easter. That was so thoughtful of you, because you say, Fiona, that you just popped it in, you know, a jiffy bag and sent it. But it's a right old bother doing that, isn't it?
It is a bother.
And because John Lanchester's Capital is a thick book. It's about 600 pages. So you wouldn't have been able to get it into a normal letterbox. You've gone somewhere else to post it, and I couldn't thank you enough. It absolutely made my week that you sent me that, and I'm going to dig into it. I haven't read it. I think I did buy it. It was out in 2008. I bought it thinking I would read it, and then I had a baby and I didn't.
Oh, yes, it's funny that, isn't it? I mean, I still laugh at myself. I took a book into the maternity hospital because I thought I'd have plenty of time.
Yeah,
funny.
It didn't happen for me, Fiona. So bless you. Thank you very much indeed. Hugely appreciate it. Right, incoming. Who's just come into the studio?
It's the Easter Bunny in the form of our executive podcast producer, Rosie, with a chocolate egg. I normally have a couple of hard-boiled eggs at this time of day, but today we've got a chocolate egg.
Look at that.
Is this, you can speak if you like, Rosie, where did this come from?
From a listener.
Has it been checked?
Do we know who?
Yes, have the poison people been on?
Do we know who sent it?
The Easter Bunny.
The Easter Bunny.
There was a card and I cannot remember who it's from.
Okay.
I can find out.
Rosie will find out.
All right, thanks, Rosie.
Thank you to that person.
Jane's made a very good point. Has somebody more junior than us taste tested it like they used
Rosie
to?
Rosie has. Okay, that's fine.
At Five Live, after the terrible white powder, was it anthrax, wasn't it, in the States
that was being sent around?
No, we're not laughing at all. So everybody was on very high anthrax alert, and a missive went round. And I'd probably be able to find this somewhere, just in case lawyers are in touch, that said at Five Live, anything addressed to us as presenters had to be opened by a junior member of staff. In case, and it's just like, you can't do that.
Brutal times.
Nobody should be opening it. But the idea that an AP or a PA is just a dispensable person on the front line of anthrax, no. The BBC gets a lot right, but sometimes...
I do open all of
we
your
We do open okay, your poison. No,
I know.
We open it mostly under the guise of that, but also just because we're a bit nosy.
Really? Okay. Have you ever found something that you rather wish you hadn't opened? Have you? What have you found? Come in, Rosie. Rosie doesn't get on often enough. Come in, Rosie.
I would say that we have had some correspondence that hasn't been... well, it's just been a bit odd. Okay. I wouldn't say it's been unkind. It's just been very strange.
Hasn't poisoned us.
Mm. Nothing... Yeah, we've not eaten... Everything we've eaten has been great, hasn't it?
Yeah,
really nice. Really
Can you just talk about the email that said I was trying to scam people?
So today, we have another email address that is for Times Radio listeners in general that we don't use because our listeners are special. But it is studio@times.radio. And somebody had emailed in and said... Hello, I've had an email from Jane Garvey asking me to do an interview about my book on BBC Radio 4, but she's asked me to pay her $160.
No.
Yes. Is this a scam? And then Emma, who is the producer for Breakfast, sent an email back saying in bold, this is a scam. Please do not transfer the money. But actually, public service announcement, we probably...
Yeah, no,
please don't.
So.
We're not asking anyone for money. No.
Jane, you've been busted.
I know. I mean, I thought. I honestly never thought.
You know. Didn't think that anyone would connect the dots, but by chiminy, they have.
You've caught up with me.
You absolute scallywag.
This is my last ever edition of Fair by Everybody. Well, what a way to go.
But you walk out $160 richer.
I do. I'm
do
retiring.
Is it insulting that it only costs $160?
There you go.
Oh, sorry.
Right.
I'm going to go and find out who sent us the Easter egg.
Yes,
I will tell
mind.
Eve.
Yeah, because that's very kind. It's very generous. It's a proper. It's a proper
it's
big
lovely.
One.
It's really. I broke my Lent with it just a moment ago.
Do you want an inside chocolate truffle, or do you want a bit of the chocolate?
Michelle.
Yeah, of course you can.
Can I have a chocolate?
Yes, of course you can. So it did say on the box though that there were it was no chocolate truffles. Mm. So it's chocolate shell, but no chocolate truffles. So the truffles are vegetable fat with a flavouring, aren't
you
they?
You don't want to think about it too much. Mm. Don't overthink it, just eat it.
I don't think that's right for you. It's milk hazelnut.
No, but I'm just reading from the box. I haven't made it up. I tell you what, we've got quite a few emails about how annoying it is to listen to people eating in public places. So do you want to just finish your mouthfuls, ladies? I'm going to bring in, and I'll talk quickly and loudly, Ricardito, who joins us from Brighton. Dear Fee, Jane and Eve, your listener talked about the cinema viewer who emptied her bag of popcorn into her jumper. I sympathise with the listener, but honestly, it could have been worse. I went to an afternoon screening last week and the person in front of me had a huge bag of popcorn. They rustled the packet so unnecessarily loudly to grab a handful and did this every half minute. If only they'd tipped it into their jumper, it would have been much more considerate. I'm a peaceful person, but I'm ashamed to confess I fantasised about violence. I didn't commit any. Instead, I left the film 30 minutes in for the sake of my blood pressure. I'm not sure if people did not used to be so noisy in the cinema or if I've become decreasingly tolerant, maybe both, with love. Well, Ricardito in Brighton, I'm completely with you. I sometimes find it so distracting that people are eating really, really loudly. For me, it's the crunchy sound of a plastic bag full of M&Ms or whatever it is. And people are just eating whole just mouthfuls all the time.
Well, it just takes you out of the cinematic experience
totally.
As well, doesn't it?
So you're spending more time thinking, is the bloke in 32A... near the end of his great big family grab bag of M&Ms, and you're not concentrating on the very latest plot twist. So actually, the woman who did pour everything into her jumper and mix it around was probably an easier person to have in the cinema than the rustlers.
Yeah.
But there is, in London, the National Film... Can you say the word?
Theatre. NFT,
thank you. Their cinema is no food. So it's a completely silent cinema.
The one on the South Bank?
Yep, because it respects the film.
Well, I did see Dr. Zhivago there about 3 or 4 years ago, and I've seen Dr. Zhivago again since on the telly. It is better on the big... Wow, it's such a good film. Yeah. I've mentioned it before, but I love it.
It's a very lovely cinema experience there, because it's quite kind of brutalist, modernist architecture, and it is a lovely place to go. So I know it wouldn't be too far to come from Brighton. It might be too far for a lot of people, especially our listeners in Melbourne. But it is completely and utterly food-free.
Now, I'm going to read this email, but I hope it doesn't sound like we're judging the young woman involved here, because I'm rather jealous of her, actually. We'll mention the name of our correspondent. It is Sarah. On a recent flight to Malaga, the volume of food consumed by my very svelte 20-ish seat buddy was simply unbelievable. The flight wasn't full. We were in a three-seater, and both agreed to leave the middle seat free, regardless of our actual seat allocation. A lovely, friendly, chatty girl she was. Perhaps she was a little bit too chatty, as I did have my puzzler book. Yes, I am a woman of a certain age. I'd come on, laden with a handbag and a flight bag, which I'd pushed under the seat, full of excess clothes and extras. She breezed on, nothing more than a passport and a Morrison's bag for life. Before takeoff, she opened a family-sized bag of fruit pastels, kindly offered them round to all the neighbouring seats. Then she ate a bag of humbugs. Good God, they took some chewing, says Sarah. The flight took off. After a couple of minutes, she took out a prawn sandwich and a whole tube of Pringles, both devoured within minutes. At this stage, I started writing in the notes column of the cryptic crossword what she was eating. She delved into the bag again quite soon afterwards for a grab bag of Quavers. Still hadn't had a drink. By this time, I'd ordered two gin and tonics, doubles. Yes, it was a deal. Don't judge.
We're not judging. She then took out a spicy chicken wrap and ate that in a couple of minutes. I was just incredulous by this stage. I should have saved my incredulity because she put her headphones on, looked like she was nodding off, then no, lurched back into the bag, took out a boxed Easter egg, ripped the cardboard, got the egg, smashed it on the table, offered me a chocolate button from the little bag, then ate the lot of the rest of it. She then put all the rubbish in the Morrison's bag, gave it to the steward and told me how much she was looking forward to a tapas lunch. I mean, that's going some, isn't it?
You've just got to be so, so thankful there wasn't any really extreme turbulence.
You really have. I'm really sorry. I've got to go and get a hanky now. This is hopeless. I do apologise.
Why? What have you dribbled?
I choked on my egg and then I'll be back.
Okay, never mind. She hasn't got a lanyard, so she won't be. Quick, Eve. Quick. Yep, let's sail again on the good ship Fee and Eve, even Fee, whichever way you like it. The many challenges of daughters and their boyfriends, vegetarian and otherwise. Okay, you need to declare yourself again as a vegetarian. What will you be having over the Easter weekend?
Well, I'm pescatarian, so I think I might be having a Good Friday fish supper.
Good Friday fish supper. Now, forgive my complete ignorance about the significance and the religious...
No. Don't dig any deeper, because I don't know.
Nope. Stop that right there. Okay, that didn't happen. Should I just do the email?
Please.
Okay. Dear Jane and Fee, not for the first time when listening to you, I've had a spooky Bromley moment as you appear to have a direct line into my life with the topics you discuss. I could write about my experience as a daughter with three brothers dealing with the care and ultimate deaths of elderly parents, or I could tell you about my place as a fourth child girl, three older brothers, and the fact my husband is also a fourth child boy, three older sisters. A lot of people have emailed us to say that they have, in fact, ended up with partners who are in the same place in the makeup of their family. So that is interesting. It's all part of affinity, isn't it? That you just do understand the everything that each of you has been through in your upbringing. It's just quite a good shorthand. You're looking at me quizzically. Jane's back, everybody.
I'm just wondering what it is, though. If it's true that you're more likely to end up with a partner in that same position as you, that's a very under-researched area, isn't it?
Just.
We need to know much, much more about this.
But we've stumbled upon this before, haven't we, with so many people having a really, really close birthday or the exact birthday to either their mother, their grandmother, or... you know, somebody in their family. It's so, these things really are spooky. We're doing spooky Bromley moment email.
I've always thought that should have its very own podcast, Spooky Bromley. We could just call it that.
We're going to carry on with our anonymous correspondent. My youngest daughter was in a wonderful 2-year-long relationship whilst at university, studying a very long, very intense course. I can still vividly remember the day she messaged me out of the blue to say that he had dumped her. She was utterly heartbroken and shocked, and it was very difficult to help her when she was a long way from home and about to take her fourth year exams. The advice I gave her was similar to the words of wisdom you both dispensed to your listener. I told her to wallow in sadness for a while, eat chocolate, be kind to herself, watch comfort TV. And I also told her that although she couldn't see it at the time, she would be better off without him in the long run, and she shouldn't give him the satisfaction of derailing her life or upsetting her exams, which she had been working so hard for. It was a very difficult time for her, and she remained sad about the relationship for months, but she did turn it to her advantage and found inner grit to do brilliantly in her exams, going on to get a first in her degree when she graduated the following year. She also made the most of her female friendships and formed very strong bonds, which might not have happened if she had continued a serious relationship at that time. And she's now in a very good place with a fantastic job, lots of very good friends, and a lovely new boyfriend. We will come to your Easter dinner in just a sec, but that is basically all being sent out to our lovely correspondent who contacted us.
So I hope she hears it.
Yeah, finding out that her boyfriend had snogged somebody else in Manchester. And actually, another one of
and
our...
in Manchester.
In Manchester.
I mean, that would be the... put the lid on it for... tin lid on it for me.
When was the last time you were in Manchester?
Well, for one of my Five Live reunions.
So quite recently.
Reasonably recently.
Why don't you just call them meeting up with friends? That's so bizarre because
I went to a karaoke place in Manchesterford that night. Yeah, that was quite funny.
But if I if I go out with lots of people that I've known since GLR, we never call it a reunion. We're just like meeting. No, we're just all meeting up.
We're slightly sending it up.
Oh, okay.
But yes. Right.
But the Manchesterification of Manchester is quite a thing, isn't it? I don't want to get too political about this. Mm. But it's almost an unrecognisable city to what it was even 30 years ago. It's a proper success story in many ways. Jane,
well,
I'm putting it out there.
I don't want to go too on too much.
Oh, God, of course you don't.
Sorry.
I mean, no, but you know, it was funny growing up. I mean, how many miles away is it? About 40 miles down the M62. And there was a culture of simply not going to Manchester. People who did go used to talk about how great the shops were, and the rest of us would go, mutter, why would you go there? I mean, it turned out they were right, but it was just bizarre. There was just, we didn't really think of it as a place worth visiting.
Well, I think Winchester and Basingstoke.
There we are,
similar.
It's probably the same. But you didn't have the argument about a ship canal, which is what broke Liverpool and Manchester apart.
Can I just say it's not the same?
Is it not the same? Is there not any rivalry? There must be.
No,
even
I don't.
In Hampshire, there must be rivalry.
I don't think there's rivalry, but I think there's probably a little bit of snobbishness, actually, if I'm honest.
Well, which is, who's snobby about who there?
Well, Winchester has a cathedral, a round table,
a couple of prisons,
a county court, county court. Yeah. Winchester is on the circuit, isn't it? So it's even bigger than a county court. And it's got a very, very well-to-do private school for boys. So I think it does get I think it would consider itself at the high table. That's right. What I'd say. And I like Basingstoke very much. They've got a more modern church there.
The only place that you've mentioned in Winchester I've been to is the prison.
I'm afraid I can't. I always think it's quite. Is it the prison that looks out over Hilliers, the garden centre? I've always thought that must be very, very cruel.
I can't remember. I do remember that at the time I went, which was to do a day in the life of a prison feature for the BBC. I went. It had a men's prison, and that was the bulk of the sort of prison estate in Winchester. But that it was also attached to a female prison. Which was part of the same sort of building, loosely, very loosely speaking. Anyway, I certainly learnt a thing or two that day, as you usually do if you go into a prison.
Can I just bring in Ella, who wanted to talk about the listener going through breakup and heartbreak, and she had said, could you expand on how to find your dignity? What does finding and keeping your dignity look like? Mm. What are the options of how to be in the face of bad behaviour? And I suppose all I meant by keeping your dignity is really, you can choose to just properly keep hold of yourself. And I think betrayal and, you know, especially when it's a very public betrayal, and cheating and lying are very, very difficult things to come to terms with, because they definitely, you know, they slightly darken your soul. They take away a little bit of your optimism as to what human nature should be. And you're right to feel very hurt by that. But I suppose your dignity is just your ability to go, well, that's them, isn't it? It's not me. And so I'm just going to stay myself, do my own business, carry on, thank you very much, and not be completely and utterly torn asunder by somebody else's behaviour.
Because
it's nasty behaviour and you don't like it. So all that love and that light that you were feeling before, it's come a cropper. You don't like and you don't love the way that person has behaved. And I think you can sail forward with a bit more dignity. And also, if you're as young as our correspondent was, make hay while the sun shines. You're at university.
Yes, but can I just say, but based on my own experience, don't ever turn to Malibu.
Okay, well, that's
a good one. Yeah, I mean,
that's
please,
a very good one.
Don't.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you can find somebody else.
Yes, find somebody else, but don't.
What?
Well, just don't drink things like that.
Okay.
I'm still thinking about what happened.
I do want to get to the end of this email, because our correspondent goes on to say, I couldn't help smiling at Jane's sympathy for anybody about to celebrate Easter with a cauliflower. The oldest daughter has had a number of relationships over the last few years, and we have welcomed all of her boyfriends into our home for various meals and celebrations. This Easter, we're going to meet her current partner for the first time, and he is vegetarian.
Oh, lovely. A vegetarian for Easter.
We have traditionally always had lamb for our Easter meal, and we all thoroughly enjoy eating it. My daughter said her boyfriend wouldn't mind if we ate meat.
Well, that's good of him.
He'd just have vegetables.
Flexible Fred.
No, I think that is nice. He's said it's fine, I'll just have the vegetables. He's trying to be being nice and don't make me something special.
All right, yeah.
Although, to be honest, a frittata only takes a couple of minutes. But I don't feel this is right, so I've spent the last 2 weeks scouring my recipe books for a vegetarian dish that will make a suitable celebration meal. I have been imagining a kind of Ottolenghi feast with aubergines, charred lettuce and carrots doused in pomegranate seeds.
No, even when you say it like that, it's still not erotic.
Oh, I think some people have probably got going. But have settled on a vegetable lasagna.
Oh, that's better.
With salads and garlic bread. I'm sure we will all enjoy it, and at least it can be prepared the day before, which will mean plenty of time for Easter egg hunts on Easter morning, and we will be having roast lamb on Good Friday before he arrives, wishing you both a very happy Easter. I love it.
Happy Easter to you
too. I love everything about that email, and I hope you have a fantastic weekend, and I hope he's a really, really nice young man, and that things are very much working out for your daughter.
Funnily enough, in my shopping delivery this morning, I got the most gargantuan cauliflower. I must have pressed on the wrong thing. I never ordered one that big. I think it would win the bloody village show in the giant cauliflower section. So what the hell am I going to do with it? I can't imagine. I'll think of something. I just want to say hello to Cecilia, who says, I've got nothing funny or earth-shattering to say. But actually, Cecilia, you then go on to say some very positive and lovely things about the podcast and how much it's meant to you over the last couple of years. And you've been through a rough time. You're now on the road to recovery. You say your husband was a rock, but you lot gave me smiles and laughs. Well, Cecilia, that's what we're here for, and thank you very much.
Can I come in with some news on the Easter egg?
Yes, please.
Firstly, it's from Tracy in North West London.
Oh, Tracy, thank you.
Thank you very much. Generous. It's really lovely.
Secondly, I'm told from our exec, the truffles are noce latte, which means hazelnut milk chocolate in Italian.
So. Oh, okay. Not
no chocolate.
Okay. Well, I don't want to dob in the other member of our team who translated that, but Felix, you're wrong.
It was a man.
A man got it wrong.
Eve, don't be ridiculous. Heavens above. Some quickies from me. Joan says,
I tell you what, could I have another one of those? Because they are absolutely...
A truffle?
Yeah, delightful.
Here we are.
Thank you.
Let's just carry on and get
it's
this
like Easter, sugar high.
Easter Maundy Thursday in the workhouse here this morning. I'm dispensing the praline doodahs like there's no tomorrow. And the way things are going, Fee, there might not be.
Yeah.
But can we actually...
I'll tell you what, if we eat this much chocolate before midday, we'll be in tears at 2 o'clock.
We will be shattered. Yes, all that sugar.
I'll have a terrible tantrum.
It'll be all sorts. I'll throw things around. Just shout out, they won't be listening, to the crew of Artemis 2. Did you watch the takeoff?
Well, I've seen little clips, because that's all we do these days, is we just watch little clips. And actually, you only needed to see a little clip to know. It had worked.
Exactly. Well, funny enough, I had a call of nature at about 2:40 in the night. Don't normally. But I think I was thinking, as you know, I like to rather boast about my ability not to go in the night. It's one of the things I put in my bio. Doesn't get up in the night.
Yeah. Well, when we did usually when we did your dating profile.
Yeah. I did include that line.
Yep, sleeps through.
Anyway, I didn't last night. So I got back into bed. And I thought it was 2:40, so I thought I'll check. Has it taken off? And it had. And Eve was going to stay up, but you didn't, did you?
No. It's 20 to midnight it was supposed to go off, so we sort of thought about it and we were like, oh yeah, maybe if it's 11 p.m.
I know, but contrast
11:40
our inability to stay up with the courage of the people prepared to sit on that rocket.
Do I think we might fall at the first hurdle of astronaut school.
Exactly. Through the first day, would we? Anyway, big shout out to them. I'm listening to you, I'm loving your work. And just fantastic. Joan, back to Joan, jacket potatoes. Many years ago, I'm 80 next month, the first recipe I cooked in domestic science was cheese boats. That sounds lovely, doesn't it? Jacket potatoes with the innards mixed with cheese and grilled. It became a firm favourite for me and my children. One day I didn't have enough cheese and just added a big dollop of plain yoghurt instead. It was superb. It adds a certain bite and fluffiness and actually became part of the recipe for us. OK, Joan, that's interesting. Thank you very much. I actually don't think you can beat a really good jacket. It was just that Stig Abel's novel, A Twist in the River, did contain... it's funny because we know that food's not a big thing for Stig, is it? He doesn't really... He's not very food adjacent. He only eats one meal a day.
Well, I think he likes his food, but he only eats one meal a day.
Yeah, he's got to focus on the mind, I think, rather than the body. I get that impression with him. He's one of those people who could have been... Who were the people who sat cross-legged on top of things for long periods of time?
Yogis.
Kind of like that.
Is he a yogi?
Kind of. Zoe, just thought you'd like to know what true influencers you are. Have you seen this?
I have.
Empty shelf of M&S, that particular disinfectant, in the Pearly Way branch.
Well, it's accompanied by the most adorable picture of a little one emptying a kitchen cupboard.
A cheeky scamp.
With purpose.
Yeah, with real purpose. Zoe says she's going to have to try in Croydon.
I know. Well...
We've all had a try in Croydon. Hasn't it ever gone well for me?
It's good of you to keep going. I just keep having to say that this is not us being influencers. We've spread the word, but it is my friend Em who started this whole thing off with her fresh-smelling hallway in Walthamstow.
Can you give my thanks to her? Because I'm actively looking forward to getting my mop out tomorrow on a bank holiday, Good Friday, bonus ball of a day off.
Yeah, and doing a bit of sluicing around.
I'm going to slop it around and I know I'll enjoy the experience.
Yeah. No, it is very nice. It's very well packaged as well. It is, though, because you can line them all up in your cupboard and they look nice. Mm. I don't want to curb our ability to prosper in terms of our sponsorship here, Eve, so you may have to cut this out. But I just find, A, the ingredients, but B, the colours on Sillit Bang, and the name is just too much. In every single shape or form, it's an aggressive product. I don't want it under my sink.
You've hit on something there. What's that all about?
It's just
Sillit Bang, when you actually think about it.
Yeah. Let's welcome in Ruth, who has been listening to us both from the very beginning of our days at the BBC. And Ruth, let's be friends in real life and don't worry about the issue of scrunching or folding your toilet paper. The last time I was in a public toilet and it did have the cat's bum dispenser, I actually took the advice of all of our listeners and I did fold instead of scrunch, and I can see what you all mean. That's obviously what you're meant to be doing. I don't know why I've been scrunching before.
Well, I mean, how many years have you scrunched?
I don't think the cat's arse dispensers have been around for very long, have they? I don't remember them in my youth.
Oh, that's true. They haven't, actually. They are a relatively new development. Somebody somewhere must have designed them.
Yeah. But also, I think in your youth...
Was it Elon Musk?
There are many times when you don't really notice loo roll and...
Well, do you remember the really brutal loo roll?
Oh, terrible tracing paper.
Absolutely horrible. God, I mean, the nation's bits were put through the most frightful ordeal. Anyway...
Yeah, I really hope that's not going to be the title of this episode. Ruth says, and this is quite a serious point, actually, but when I read it, I completely agree with you. I've written many emails in my head, et cetera, et cetera. Watching Molly versus the Machines has propelled me into a turmoil of shock, disbelief, incredible sadness, anger and frustration. I wanted to acknowledge what an amazing and brilliantly crafted film this is, and I'm confused as to how it's gone under the radar. It's up there with Adolescence, in my opinion, and needs the airtime and recognition for the power it has. This should be watched by young people and their parents, and made me wonder if we could not start our own algorithm by promoting it very simply on social media. Would that be ironic or maybe just antagonistic, hurtful and disrespectful to Molly and her family? Well, that's a very good point to make, but I think that her family and her father, Ian, who's done so much work on making sure that the true message of what happened to his daughter gets across, I think he just wants as many people as possible to know what's happening behind the screens that our kids are using. But I think that point about it going under the radar is interesting, Jane, because it hasn't done the same kind of business in terms of being in conversations. And I mean, adolescence was mentioned in Parliament, wasn't it?
It was extraordinary.
It was a real kind of wow. And I think Molly versus the Machines, it tells you so much that you don't know about what's
but
behind.
But it's real, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it is completely real.
And maybe we find a fictional version easier to deal with.
Do you think it is?
Well, I can't think of any other explanation.
The film is done so brilliantly because it uses actors to recreate the inquest and it uses it's such a clever thing to do. It asks the machines to explain what happened to Molly. So the algorithms and the AI that contributed to her death are then asked to tell us, the viewer, about Molly. It makes you realise how incredibly advanced they have become and how much they have taken from the real world to shove back at us. And I don't understand why that hasn't been talked about more. So I would say, if anybody hasn't watched it, it's not an easy watch at all, but it is of our times. That's the point. It's one of those things, it's kind of like, if you really want to understand what's happening with your kids and with the social media platforms, I've not seen anything that explains it as well as that film. And, you know, maybe over the Easter weekend you don't want to watch all of it, but I would recommend it. I think it informs
and
your choice.
On all four, isn't it?
Yes, it is on all four. Yeah. And it's about an hour and a half. And even if you can't do all of it, I would definitely say the opening 20 minutes tell you things that you won't or you just won't know unless you've worked for one of those companies.
Yeah. Okay. And actually, we had an email saying everybody should read Careless People. I think the Careless People book is now out in paperback because I think it was only hardback. And, you know, I appreciate that. That can be a stretch for a lot of people. But I think the paperback, if it's not already out, must be coming out quite soon. Susie says, some of your listeners may not know that the film Project Hail Mary is actually a book by Adam Weir. The book is 16 hours, 10 minutes in audiobook form. So the attempt to condense it into a 2.5-hour film piqued my curiosity. And my conclusion is they did a good job. There's much more to the story than you see on the screen. The narrator is outstanding. The humour in the book feels very authentic and dry. Most importantly, the friendship between Grace and Rocky is still incredibly beautiful. I mean, this does seem farcical, but honestly, the friendship established between the astronaut played by Ryan Gosling and a lump of rock with tentacles is incredibly moving. You're looking at me as though I've totally lost my marbles.
No, I'm going to... My jury's out until I see it.
Okay.
I've had pebbles I'm very fond of.
Oh, no, I keep pebbles, yeah. As you know.
I found a heart-shaped one, actually, on the beach at West Wittering recently. It was really good, Jane, because it was properly like a heart.
Yes.
So one side of it was bigger than the other, because hearts aren't that perfect asymmetrical sense. No. So
they're quite jagged.
Yeah, so I thought, okay, this is great. This is a sign.
Have you got a favourite pebble? Contact Rory Stewart and Alice. No, it's funny when you go to a beach, I always pick something up and bring it home. And it can be a pebble, it can be, as I once found on Crosby Beach.
Could be a man.
No, I found this really weird tin of rations from World War II.
Flash your headlights twice. It's Jane Garvey.
It's an upside down pineapple beaming from my forehead. Pebbles, why is it that certain pebbles demand to be taken home?
I don't know.
No, but
I mean, I just feel in this conversation at every single step of it, we could have inserted the word man for pebble and it would still make sense.
That's only your thinking. It's certainly not mine. I am a bit boggled by this. Susie says she has listened to that book, Project Hail Mary, 6 times.
Oh my gosh, what, the one that's 32.5 hours long?
And she's seen the film twice. I don't understand. There's another popcorn. My enjoyment of the film only being slightly marred by spilling my entire box of popcorn on the floor. I mean, I honestly, I've never got popcorn. It's messy, it's pointless, it's tasteless.
I've never got watching things on repeat. I can't do it.
I didn't get that either. No. And certainly listening to an audiobook. I mean, I could start Ken Follett's Century Trilogy all over again, but I'm not going to because I can only ever do things like that once.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's true.
Susie, I'm boggled, but thank you for that.
Anonymous from Stenning. Now, we do hope we're coming to Stenning.
Well, we think we are.
In May.
Yeah.
We had it in our diary, but it's yet TBC. I mean, but if we are coming to Stenning, hello, Stenning.
The crew of Artemis 2 must listen to us and think, those two, I'll tell you what, they're hoping to be going to Stenning in May. Yeah.
Our anonymous correspondent,
go where quite a few people have been before,
says, scaffolders, yes.
Oh, yeah, I love this.
My husband died nearly 4 years ago, which was very sad. Weeks of paperwork ensued, as it does, including investigating his cause of death, juggling my cancer treatments around possible funeral dates, and not least completing the contract we'd started with large deposit already paid to complete the installation of 14 solar panels. You've had so much going on there, and I hope you're okay. And we send thoughts about losing your husband. You go on to say, the scaffolder's timetable brought a happy team to my door and roof 3 days before the funeral. Full on, sunny day, big heat. All I can say is that as I sat upstairs in my office typing death notices and on hold to bereavement departments of various banks, etc., the sweary bants and fulsome singing outside broadcasting to the village kept me on the verge of hysteria. But the best bit was glancing through the window to eyeball at very close quarters the naked, ripped and tanned mid-torso of Steve as he grappled with those connectors and his special tool. Sorry to objectify you, lads, but it was very cheering. Thanks. Well, we allow objectification when it's necessary.
We do.
It absolutely is, in your case, very necessary indeed. And I'm sure that Steve and his special tool didn't realise the joy that they were giving. And I'm sure that every single, what would you call it? The connector on a scaffold.
What would she be? Almighty, why are you asking me this?
Because you ask me things all the time and I just look them up on Google. So I hope all of his what's-its, his scaffolding connectors, were very, very firm.
This episode of Off Air is brought to you by Simpson Travel.
Award-winning, exceptional, specialists, not generalists. Over 45 years of experience. I'm talking about...
us?
Actually, let's be honest, I could be. But in this instance, I'm talking about Simpson Travel. They're a Mediterranean holiday company that promises exceptional service from start to finish.
Whether you're looking for a romantic retreat, boutique hotel, award-winning villa, or a luxury family holiday, Simpson visit every one of their properties so you can speak to someone who's actually been there before you book.
From airport parking to an in-villa massage or a private chef, Simpson take charge of the details that can really make a holiday, so you can sit back and enjoy the moment. And Simpson caters to destinations across the Mediterranean. France, Turkey, Portugal, Italy, Mallorca, and my favourite, Greece. I'm still in my Greek era, Fee.
Well, you are ancient. Choose Simpson Travel because your time is precious. Visit simpsontravel.com and book your 2026 holiday today.
This episode of Off Air is brought to you by Specsavers, the seeing and hearing experts.
Eyes and ears?
That's right. Specsavers might be the nation's favourite optician, but did you know they also care a lot about your hearing? And in fact, they have done for over 20 years, since 2002, but not enough people know about it.
Well, I'm not being funny, Jane, but maybe they should change their name. What about Specs and Hearing Savers?
Yeah, I like your creativity. Should have gone to Specs and Hearing Savers, though. Doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, does it?
Spec save ears?
Stop it now. They probably should have thought of a different name 20 years ago, but I think, realistically, the ship has sailed. Who's got time to change all those signs, all the logos? Let's just stick to Specsavers, if you don't mind.
OK. It is undeniable that the world is getting noisier and our ears are having to work even harder to hear what's important above the din of daily life. So put your ears in good hands with Specsavers, despite the name.
Book a free hearing check today, in-store or online.
People are a funny bunch. For every careful Colin, you've got your laid-back Lisa. So when it comes to cash ISAs, at Leeds Building Society, it's not one size fits all. You've got that person who's happy to lock their money away, and that person who wants to keep their options open. You've got that person who likes to chat it through, and that person who already knows exactly what they want. So whatever kind of saver you are, as a Which? Recommended provider for savings, we might just have the cash ISA for you. Leeds Building Society. Visitors online or in branch.
William Boyd is one of our finest novelists. A Good Man in Africa, Any Human Heart, Armadillo, Ordinary Thunderstorms, 18 novels, plays, screenplays and journalism. They sprawl luxuriantly over the last 40 years. And now Mr. Boyd has brought us a new character to love, Gabriel Dax, the protagonist of his new trilogy, A Reluctant Spy, having been recruited from a life as a travel writer. Two books are out already, Gabriel's Moon and The Predicament. You're very welcome in our studio, William. How are you?
slightly harassed. You've been over the world's worst taxi driver, but you know, I made it.
Well, we're very grateful that you have. Tell us a little bit more about Gabriel.
Well, it's, you know, I've written quite a few spy novels, including a James Bond continuation novel, and I'm sort of fascinated by that world. And I finished a very long whole life novel called The Romantic, which takes place over the 19th century. I thought, I must do something a little bit more fun and kind of racy. And so I thought of this idea of taking a travel writer as a reluctant accidental spy. And I think quite a lot of travel writers or journalists are often recruited as stringers for MI6. So there's some precedent there. And it allowed me to write about spying from the outside, as it were. I mean, I know nothing about how the bureaucracy and the organisation work. So my spies, perforce, have to be like me, innocent and ignorant. And so Gabriel, he's a young man in his 30s, three or four books under his belt, is drawn into this world of espionage, much against his best intentions, but actually begins to find out that he's got quite a talent for it. And so I thought I'd write a trilogy of novels about this young man, and the kind of narrative arc, the narrative drive, runs through the three books. Number three will be out this September.
Oh, thank goodness.
And it's an exploration of what it must be like to have your life taken over, I suppose.
Now, it strikes me, William Boys, that maybe you've been tapped up to be a spy, because what a fantastic cover it would be to be the writer who's constantly investigating places where spying might happen.
Well, I haven't been tapped up. I'm glad. So I'd be a very bad spy, not remotely intrepid.
You're just a double bluffer, aren't you?
Yeah. Yes, that's not remotely intrepid. I've met a couple of spies in my time, but because I'm writing about a world that Gabriel knows nothing about, I'm free to invent my own agency within the agency. I'm free to invent my handler for Gabriel, a mysterious, alluring woman called Faith Green, and you know, spin my own tale without having to make it like, you know, John le Carré or Graham Greene or Ian Fleming, all writers who were actual spies and who knew how the place worked, you know.
As with so much of your writing, you set fiction against fact, and this is against the background of real events. And in fact, Patrice Lumumba, a man who could have changed the direction of the DRC, features, doesn't he?
Yes, because I was born in Ghana, and I remember the name Patrice Lumumba, even as a child, being bandied around, because Kwame Nkrumah, who was then president of Ghana, was a great supporter of Lumumba. And when Lumumba was assassinated by the CIA, MI6, and the Belgian Secret Service, it was as if an African hero had been killed in 1961. And it was interesting, because all these novels are set in the 60s, you know, height of the Cold War. This is one of the first acts of wanton aggression, if you like, that the great powers took against a democratically elected African leader, and decided that they didn't want him around anymore, so they just had him assassinated. It's, you know, there are echoes today of that kind of adventurism, but in the 60s it was kind of off the dial, not just in Africa but in Central America in particular, that the CIA could more or less do what they wanted, with the collusion of MI6 and the mafia, if required. And so I was looking at that period of sort of unbridled United States hegemony, when they just, if they didn't like somebody running a country, they organised a coup or had him assassinated. Sounds familiar.
as you've already alluded to, times haven't changed that much. I mean, do you think that the CIA really has changed in the way that it operates?
Well, I think it has. And I think that the difference between this now and the 60s, in the 1960s, there were very disaffected senior members of the CIA who didn't like John Fitzgerald Kennedy or his brother, and particularly after the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs failed invasion of Cuba. And so I think that there isn't that kind of rogue element, what do I know, within the organisation. But there was no doubt at the time there were people going their own way, and making decisions that had nothing to do with the executive branch of the United States government.
Patrick Lumumba's case was in the news recently because finally somebody has actually been charged in connection with the assassination. Yeah. I wonder what you made of that.
Well, I thought, what great timing. But it's interesting because the case is genuinely shocking. And this person who's been arrested, a 93-year-old ex-Belgian diplomat who was sort of involved in the arrest and then assassination and then physical disappearance of Lumumba. His body was dissolved in a vat of sulfuric acid. So there's nothing left of him. But it's a case that still sort of haunts people because it was so violent and so blatant. And I think given the situation in Africa at the time, with these countries just getting their independence, to have somebody like Lumumba, who was a key figure in African liberation, if you like, just removed, still is very disturbing. And then you see things happening today which remind you that, you know, he who wields the biggest power often can exert the sway he wants to.
Yeah. So your tricky. Spies in your trilogy here, they are men on ferries, they're art collectors, they've got hats and umbrellas, they're dressed very well, they know how to behave in private members' clubs. What do you think a modern spy looks like?
Well, I think actually modern spying is quite boring because it's really just about electronic surveillance, I think, and whistleblowing now. That's one of the reasons why I liked setting this in the 1960s, because it's analogue spying. You know, if you want to make a phone call, you have to look for a phone box. You know, you might send somebody a postcard saying, can we meet on Monday at 3 o'clock in such a pub? So it was, you know, I'm old enough to remember the 60s quite vividly. And it was a fun time travelling back to that era to see how you coped. I mean, obviously we did cope, but it's so different from today. And I think that gives the novels an extra frisson that you have no internet, you have no GPS satellite systems, there's no mobile phones. Life was simpler, but perhaps more complicated, paradoxically.
Gabriel is a very decent travel writer, isn't he? And in fact, it made me smile a bit, the ease with which he can get a new book commissioned. So he thinks, Rivers, I'm interested in Rivers. And his publisher says, that's a marvellous idea, please do write that. How did you get published? Was it an easy journey for you when you started?
No, not really. I mean, I think it was easier when I was trying to get published than it is today, in fact. And there were more avenues for young writers to wander up. I mean, I wrote a lot of short stories that were published in various magazines. It's very hard to get a short story published today. But I was picked out of the slush pile. I mean, I had about 10 stories published, and I sent autonomously to two publishers this collection and wrote saying, by the way, I've written a novel featuring a character who appears in two of these stories. Into the blue. And, you know, I never forget the day I got the letter back from Hamish Hamilton, my then editor, Christopher Sinclair Stevenson, saying, we'd like to publish your short stories, but we want to publish the novel first, if you don't mind. Of course, I hadn't written the novel. It was a lie. So I told more lies and said, the manuscript's in a terrible state. I have to retype it. And I wrote my first novel, A Good Man in Africa, in a kind of white heat of panic and dynamism in about 3 months. And I did confess later to my publisher that it hadn't been written. But that was a stroke of luck, and everybody needs a stroke of luck at the beginning of their careers especially. And so I got published. It was well reviewed. It won a couple of prizes. It became a paperback. And you know, here we are, 40-odd years later.
History, yeah. Do you still work to a very structured timetable? Because I've read that every book takes 3 years and you are quite firm about what you do within that three-year period.
Yes, I've sped up, actually, with this trilogy. I will have written three novels in 3 years, which are never again. But I think for a trilogy, it's quite a good idea because readers don't have to wait, you know, 3 or 4 years between books in order to find out what happens next. But usually it takes me, you know, 2 to 3 years to write a novel. And I plan it in great detail before I start writing. That probably explains why it takes me longer. I don't start on page one until I know exactly how it's going to end. And then I write not fairly quickly, but not that fast. But I know my destination, and so I've never abandoned a novel. And I just, you know, because I've planned it so in such detail, if I'm in the middle of chapter 15, I know exactly how chapter 15 is going to end and how chapter 16 begins. So it's quite structured and dogged, but, you know, works for me. It's not for every novelist in the world, but it means, I've never abandoned a novel, and all the novels I've written have turned out pretty much as I wanted them to be.
What do you do about the feast and famine of the imagination, though? I mean, does yours just never have that? You're just on an even keel all the time.
I think so. I think it's, again, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't go on a course and learn how to, you know, boost your imagination. I think it's one of the things that makes you a novelist or makes you an artist. Your mind just works that way. And because I work in different media, film, television, and theatre, my mind is always sort of bubbling with ideas, and I write them down in a notebook just in case I forget them. And I get ideas for a short story, or I'm commissioned by somebody to write five stories for the radio or something. So I'm constantly busy. You know, my mind is constantly thinking about stories and characters. And, you know, touch wood, no sign of it dying down or giving up. I think my mind is functioning as well as it ever has been, even if the old soft machine is beginning to show signs of wear and tear.
Nonsense, Jane, nonsense.
Well, Claire just wants to say thank you for writing my Any Human Heart. It's my favourite book of all time, profoundly moving. Thank you, Claire, for the message. In fact, we've got a colleague who's waiting outside for a copy of Any Human Heart to be signed, haven't we? And David wants to ask, Gabriel Dack's fabulous creation. I'm loving the books and that 60s ambience. Any plans for a screen adaptation?
Yes, there are plans for a screen adaptation, for a movie, in fact, not TV. And I have already written the script of the film of Gabriel's Moon. And we're now entering the world of development hell, whereby who's going to be in it, who's going to direct it, comes into play. But the books have been optioned and the script commissioned. So, you know, we've started, so we'll finish, I hope. But I never get my hopes up in the very fickle world of the film industry. We're underway.
Do you have who would play? Who is your Gabriel in your head, or can't you tell us?
Well, I can. I'm probably putting a terrible hex on the whole process. But the person I'd really like to play Gabriel Dax is a young English actor called Josh O'Connor.
Oh, I know.
Yes.
And I think there's something about, I mean, I've been following his career. I never
met him.
That's
a good choice.
But it's something about his look and his kind of mercurial character that I think would work very well. But, you know, that's, as I say, I probably put a curse on it. But his star is rising fast, so he may be beyond us, for all I know, by the time we get round to casting.
And what about Faith? So Faith is an essential figure.
Yes, I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, it's unusual for me to have sort of come up with an idea for Gabriel, because usually I never try to cast the movie as I'm writing it, because inevitably you won't get that person you want. But we're kind of blessed with, she's got to be a sort of 40-something, she's older than Gabriel, very cool, quite chic and controlling, and almost a femme fatale, but we hope she won't be fatale for Gabriel.
Mm. You do have such an eye for ladies' wear in these books. So the way that you describe Faith's outfits, I think, is quite different from the way that you've described what people wear in your other books. Is it to you?
I think it's one of my sort of tips that I give younger. I think that what you wear, what you eat, what you drive, what your house looks like, is very important in the kind of subliminal background textures of any novel. And I've often been rebuked for going into too much detail about three-course meals and so on. So I took this, Faith's wardrobe, if you like, sort of from Ian Fleming, because when I wrote my James Bond novel, I reread all Fleming's novels. And Bond, unusually, you wouldn't believe this, is actually very interested in couture and women's clothes. And he can tell if a skirt's been cut on the bias and what material it's made of. So I thought if it's good enough for James Bond, it's good enough for Gabriel Dax. But I think because he's a writer, anyway, he notices things. And because he's obsessed with Faith and he's completely smitten by her, every time they meet, he kind of checks her out, and that's involved with her hair, her Alice band, and what she's wearing that day, because she's quite fashionable. So
she's very fashionable.
She's in 60s style.
Yeah, you know. I love the detail, absolutely love the detail of what she was wearing. Can we change tack, as we only have you for another couple of minutes? And this really is a gear change, so come with us. Yeah, we're going from, I think, fourth down to about first. You spend half your year in the Dordogne. How are those border controls working for you? We were talking yesterday about the difficulty of actually getting in and out, certainly of some of the smaller airports in Europe, because people are doing the fingerprinting thing now. So have you been very badly affected at Brive-la-Gaillarde, gateway to the Dordogne airport?
Well, it's Bergerac Airport, in fact, but I have had my fingerprints taken at Bergerac Airport. No, that the border controls haven't been so bad. What has been turning our life upside down is the expletive deleted Brexit rules, where you're only allowed to stay 90 days out of 6 months. Well, you know, we've been living in this house for 30 years, it's our home, but now we have to count the days that we're allowed to stay in it. And very often, you know, in the summer, for example, you're there for 2 months or 10 weeks, suddenly you've been there for 70 days and you're only allowed 90. You think, well, I wouldn't mind coming back for Christmas. So constantly irked, to put it mildly, about this Brexit rule that you're only allowed 90 days in every 6 months. You can't, if you've only been 40 days, you can't carry on your extra days to the next half. So it's very rigid. And now we've got all these retinal recognition barometric devices. They know exactly how long you've been in the country, and you cannot fake it. And the last thing you'd want to do is to arrive at Bergerac Airport and be deported because you're on day 91, you know. So it's a constant reminder of how deeply stupid Brexit was and how it's impinged on our lives in a way we would never have imagined, having lived in southwest France for, you know, 30 odd years.
Jerry Halliwell was on the programme and the podcast when her latest young adult fiction came out, and she credits you with really putting her on that track. What did you do?
Well, she's been very kind. I met Jerry at some do in Buckingham Palace, of all places, and she told me she was writing this children's book, and we got on well, and she said, would you mind having a read of it? So I said, of course not, I'll happily read it. And I read it, and it seemed to me that there was one major change that she should do to make it work better, which was sounds simple, as you change the pronoun from first person to third person, because it changes any novel if you make that shift. And she did it, and I think it worked in a totally different way for her, and the book was a huge success, and she sold it in America and everything like that. So it's very kind of her to credit me with a significant piece of advice in her writing life. But it was just, you know, I am an old pro now, and I've written all sorts of fiction, and I know how the nuts and bolts and the gearings of fiction work. And it seemed to me that by making her novel first person, she was restricting the viewpoint too much, and by going to the third, you know, she could have her cake and eat it.
Yeah. I mean, apart from anything else, William, it does prove that she wrote the book herself, and actually an awful lot of people who are as famous as she is in a different lane have been gifted publishing deals for books that actually they haven't written themselves.
No, she's a bona fide author, Jerry, you know, absolutely hardworking. She's writing more and more, I think. So, yes, true, there are ghosts out there that will help celebrities come up with a quote-unquote novel, but she's the real deal.
When is the third in the trilogy out?
It's called Cold Sunset, and it's coming out on the 3rd of September. So not far off. Cover is done. Plans are afoot. I will write more Gabriel Dax novels down the line, I think. He's too good a character to stop with.
So
And yep. we're only at 1964, for heaven's sake. So, you know, I've got the whole of the 60s, the 70s. So it might keep me going in my dotage.
Yeah, well, if you got up to the present day, there's enough to keep you busy for about another 150 years.
Far, you know.
So many people want to say hello to you and they want to say thank you. Christine says, I was lucky enough to meet William Boyd at a book signing in Oxford's Blackwells at about 1990. I think he signed my book, An Ice Cream War, Any Human Heart, is one of my husband's favourite books too. It's lovely to see you, William. Thank you very much indeed for running back over London Bridge in order to make the interview on time. So the predicament is out now and we shall look forward to the third book in the Gabriel Dax series in September. Happy Easter to you.
Thank you very much.
William Boyd, very happy Easter. How do you eat yours?
Have a happy Easter, everybody. And we are back on, a week on Monday. So it's Monday the 14th. We'll be back in your ears and clogging up your life generally. So plenty of time to get in an email at janeandfee@times.radio. Congratulations, you've staggered somehow to the end of another Off Air with Jane and Fee. Thank you.
If you'd like to hear us do this live, and we do it live every day, Monday to Thursday, 2 till 4 on Times Radio.
The jeopardy is off the scale. And if you listen to this, you'll understand exactly why that's the case. So you can get the radio online on DAB or on the free Times Radio app.
Off Air is produced by Eve Salisbury and the executive producer is Rosie Cutler.
Everything you know and love starts with water. Your dog, your car, your internet. And then there is just the small miracle of keeping us alive. Without drinking water, you wouldn't survive more than 3 days. So let's raise a glass to clean water. It's hard to imagine life without it. Seriously, how is it that a million people die every year because they lack access to clean water? That's not just unthinkable. That's wrong. Donate to WaterAid today. Just £2 a month can give life-changing clean water.
Hi, I'm Jessie Ware, host of Is It Normal? My podcast is currently being sponsored by Noobie. Rapid Bottle is the latest addition to Noobie's complete feeding system, the Rapid Team. It's made of medical-grade glass with a grippy silicone coating, so you don't have to worry about microplastics leaching under heat. It also works great alongside the Rapid Sterilise Plus, lighting up the room with a UV glow as it sterilises in just 2 minutes. It's safe, it's fast, and it's very chic. Find the Rapid Bottle at Noobie.com. Boots and Amazon.
Hi, we're Backmarket. We sell expertly refurbished tech, like phones for talking to your friends or your AI babysitter.
Now playing Rockabye Baby in style of Norwegian black metal.
Either way, this expertly refurbished tech costs way less than new, guaranteed by the Backmarket promise. 1 year warranty and 30-day free returns on every purchase.
Up next, Twinkle Twinkle Little Star Grindcore Remix.
Backmarket, where the world shops refurbished tech.